At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. And so, after all the drill, baby, drill chants from the GOP, it's Democratic President Barack Obama pointing to America's offshore waters for oil and gas. Environmentalists are up in arms. Some Republicans are saying more. What's the White House thinking on drilling, energy, and climate change? This hour On Point, the move to drill offshore and the Obama energy agenda. You can join the conversation. Did you see the president, this president, call for offshore drilling? Will this save us, hurt us, get us closer to a clean energy future? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's President Obama at Andrews Air Force Base yesterday, presenting his administration's new energy plan, which incorporates offshore drilling.
Today we're announcing the expansion of offshore oil and gas exploration, but in ways that balance the need to harness domestic energy resources and the need to protect America's natural resources.
Okay, let's figure that out. Joining us first today from Washington is Juliet Eilprin. She's national environmental reporter for The Washington Post, is on page one today with the drilling story. Juliet, welcome.
Thanks so much, Tom.
So what's going on here? Bottom line, is this about those extra barrels of oil and some gas that will eventually come in here? Is this about politics and the president's larger climate/energy agenda? What's going on, Juliet?
It's more about politics and the larger climate and energy agenda than it is about producing barrels of oil and gas, although, you know, it will produce that ultimately. But essentially, what Obama is trying to do is signal that he's committed to expanding domestic energy production as well as just curbing greenhouse gas emissions. And this is a signal that he's trying to send both to moderate and conservative Democrats and the handful of moderate Republicans who in the Senate could determine whether a climate legislation succeeds or fails.
And why is that signal important?
Because basically it's a bottom line that a lot of these moderate and conservatives have been telling the White House. They've been saying, look, we understand that you care about global warming and you want to increase efficiency and you want to make sure that we have less pollution that's contributing to global warming. But what we're really focused on is dependence on foreign oil and the message that we can convey to our constituents that we're producing more energy at home. We're not just asking them to make sacrifices in order to reduce their carbon footprint.
Let's look at exactly what's being opened up here. There was a moratorium for a long, long time. George Bush pushed on this front. Now Barack Obama is pushing in some areas, in parts of Alaska, maybe pushing back. What's the map look like, Juliet, of where Obama is pointing and saying, you know, drill?
Right. In our story today, I call it an offshore political gerrymander, because essentially what he's done is opened up areas where drilling is popular and closed areas where drilling is not. So in other words, in terms of what's open, he's going to allow drilling to proceed 50 miles off Virginia coast. He's opened up parts of the mid and south Atlantic coast so that potentially 125 miles off Florida's coast there can be drilling. And in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, where oil and gas companies are confident their resources and which is adjacent to where there's been drilling for a long time. And then in Alaska, he's protected Bristol Bay, an area that's a huge resource both for seafood and just marine life, but has said that he's willing to have studies in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas. And then again, simultaneously, he's protecting the West Coast, particularly off California, where drilling is very unpopular, and off New Jersey. So those are areas where he's saying we won't do it, particularly because he knows there's domestic opposition there.
Does the Alaska drilling add up to a net increase there? Or, I mean, he's also pulling back on some of the leases that were sold, I think, under George W. Bush in the North.
Well, he's actually, what he's doing is he's canceling four lease sales that had been scheduled to go forward. He's allowing a major sale that happened in 2008 to stand. So again, it's kind of splitting it down the middle in some sense. And what he's saying is again, it's kind of one of these things where there's the potential for a lot of offshore oil drilling under this proposal, but whether it happens or not is unclear, because what Interior Secretary Ken Salazar has made clear is that there's going to be extensive study to both see what would be the environmental impacts of drilling in some of these areas and also how much potential oil and gas is out there. So you know, again, it's kind of saying we're open to doing this, but it's opening the door, but it's not giving it a green light.
What does this mean in practical terms, in terms of the flow of oil? I mean, the estimate I keep seeing is that if all the off-limits areas were opened up, it would maybe come to 18 billion barrels of oil, which is about 2.5 years of U.S. consumption. Is that a big deal if everything were opened up?
Right. I mean, again, in the grand scheme of things, it's a fraction of our national energy supply. As you know, Obama has said consistently, I believe, you know, it's something like, you know, we have the potential to produce 2% of our consumption domestically. So it's still it's a fraction of our overall supply. Again, it certainly, you know, does mean something. It obviously is a significant number of barrels. And it also, again, is much more for kind of the principle and kind of the political concession that he's making, that you do something at home to help show people that you're both creating domestic jobs and that, you know, you have the idea that we're less dependent. Although, again, really, you know, when you talk about electrifying the national car fleet, that would do a lot more to make us less dependent on foreign oil than a move like this.
What about the environmental impact? I'm looking here at Sierra Club is unhappy. Greenpeace right. says, you know, is this it? You know, the president's going to adopt Sarah Palin's drill baby drill campaign. Here's Environment America says it makes no sense to threaten our beaches, wildlife, and tourism industry with spills and other drilling disasters when we're about to unleash the real solutions to oil dependence, cleaner cars and cleaner fuels. What is the potential environmental impact?
Well, certainly there's a significant potential for risk, particularly when you talk about oil spills. And obviously, people think of oil spills in kind of this, you know, huge, the ones that are really big, like Exxon Valdez and things like in Alaska. But really, actually, chronic oil leakage and the pollution that stems from these operations is something that really can affect marine life. And so certainly that's a concern. And really, you know, there wasn't a single national environmental group that really said this was a good thing, although there certainly were a handful of ones like the Environmental Defense Fund that again framed it as this may be the compromise that one needs for the broader goal of getting a price on carbon that can reduce emissions. So they're definitely not happy with it, and you know, there can be some impacts. And again, you know, part of the questions is that, you know, you really can't predict how operations are going to react and, you know, how they're going to do, particularly if you have hurricanes or other environmental factors at play.
And if this is a political two-step, you know, give a little here and then get a little something, what's the something? Is there now a climate/energy bill that will be put forward, you know, after the holiday recess here? Does the White House think it would have the votes in the House and the Senate to push through something big or not?
They don't think this will deliver, say, all the votes to get a compromise climate and energy bill. However, they definitely say that they've been encouraged by the reaction of some key lawmakers. I would cite to people we said in our story, including Mary Landrieu, a Democrat from Louisiana, Judd Gregg, a Republican from New Hampshire. Those are two members, along with Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski, Alaska's two senators, really that the White House has been courting for quite a long time on this bill. And the fact that they're more open to it, they see as you know, a promising sign, though whether that actually will end up being votes in favor of a bill at the end of the day, particularly this Congress, remains unclear.
Let's go to Houston, Texas. Amy Myers Jaffe joins us. She's a fellow in energy studies at the James A. Baker Institute for Public Policy. Amy Jaffe, welcome back to On Point. Will this satisfy the oil industry? Is this what they want?
I think I need to correct a few things you've already said on your show that are incorrect. First of all, going to
you think
to
Juliet,
electric-
the national environmental reporter of the Washington Post, is dead wrong?
Yes. First of all, we have the potential to see something like 1 million barrels a day of oil production from these areas that would open or higher, and that would reduce our imports from the Persian Gulf by up to 40%. So, you know, the idea that it's 2%, that's too low. It's not that at all. Right. Second
so,
of all,
so how much then? How much are you
saying?
How much?
It could be over 1 million. It could be over, you know, 10% or even 15% of our oil use.
For how long?
It could be for years, for 50 years.
Mm, okay.
Right.
So that's if everything were opened up, Amy, just to be clear?
No, for the things that the president is proposing opening
okay.
up.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. The second thing is that's also important to understand. When people talk about electric plug-in cars, electricity seems invisible, but it comes from a fuel. And so it has to come from a fuel that we produce. And it's either going to come from an imported fuel or it's going to come from a fuel we produce in the United States. And right now, we generate most of our electricity in the United States with coal and natural gas. So if we're going to produce electric cars and we're going to use coal, then that's worse for global warming than anything else we could do, right? So we really need to be thinking carefully about how much natural gas do we need and the potential to produce natural gas in these regions. Again, Virginia, we're talking about all natural gas. We're not talking about oil. And natural gas, quote unquote, doesn't spill because it's a gas. So I'd like to read you something from the National Academy of Sciences. In the last 15 years, we have not had a major platform spill in this country. We have had 3 major hurricanes that were worse than any hurricanes we've seen here in the Gulf Coast, you know, since the turn of the century. And we did not have a major spill. We have had incredibly large spills from imported oil coming in oil tankers, as the correspondent so correctly mentioned, the Exxon Valdez. When we take oil around in tankers, because we're not drilling at home, we have a 15 times greater risk of having a major spill that will harm wildlife and beaches than from drilling at home.
Of course, people in Santa Barbara will remember all the way back to 1969 and their big spill there. But we'll come back and talk about that. Amy Myers Jaffe, please stand by in Houston. Juliet Alpert in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the White House decision to drill for oil and gas offshore in new areas and the Obama vision now for energy and the environment. Juliet Alpert is here, national environmental reporter for The Washington Post. Amy Myers Jaffe is with us from the James A. Baker Institute for Public Policy in Houston, Texas. Let's go right to our callers. Terry, Brewerstown, Tennessee. Terry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Yes.
Hi.
The lady representing the oil companies conveniently forgot that we have wind turbines and solar installations that can recharge electric cars. Also, I've worked in the construction industry for quite some time, worked on coal-fired power plants, worked on dams, and I've worked on nuclear plants. And for the point is that for the amount of energy and time to build an oil rig and take it out to sea and set it up, you can have several wind turbines built and up and operating, generating electricity.
So put the energy elsewhere. We hear that, Terry. I'll take it to Amy Myers Jaffe. Here's a little bit from the Sierra Club president. This is Michael Bruin explaining his group's opposition to offshore drilling. This is an interview with CNN yesterday.
We've had this debate for years, of course. It's really more of the same. We don't think that expanded oil drilling actually solves the problem. What it does, in fact, do is it perpetuates our dependence on dirty energy. You know, if we want to build the clean energy economy of tomorrow, we need to stop subsidizing the oil industry today.
Amy, first to you. President Obama says this is a bridge to a cleaner future. You hear our caller says let's put our energy into building that out right now, wind, solar, and all the rest. He'd rather have the effort there. What do you say, Amy?
Well, first of all, let me say I'm a professor at Rice University. We're a private independent university, and I don't represent the oil industry. But I do know a lot about energy, and I know how much potential we have in this country to transition to wind and solar. It's going to take a really long time, and we use a lot of energy. So if we're going to drive around in our cars and we're going to air condition our homes and do all the things we're currently doing at the rates we're currently doing them, we're still going to have to use fossil fuels for the time being. So if we're going to have to use fossil fuels, the question is, at what price, for how long? And how long is it going to take us to transition to renewable energy? Renewable energy is currently only 2% of our energy mix. In addition, wind, Texas is the largest wind state in the country. We know a lot about wind here, but wind blows at night, and you're in bed at night, and you're not driving at night, and you're not turning on your plasma TV in the middle of the night, and you are not turning on your lights in the middle of the night. So we need to be realistic about the transition, and we need to understand that natural gas has 50% less carbon emissions than oil or coal. And I think most of the drilling that we're looking at in this country is really going to be identifying natural gas. And let me repeat, natural gas does not spill. And also, it's a clean fuel. And also, we have already had tremendous gains in the industry's ability to produce oil and gas without spills. There are 4,000 active platforms in the Gulf of Mexico. We have not had a major spill at a platform in 15 years. The thing you talked about from California was in 1967.
Yes.
We're in 2010. You can't cite me a major accident that has happened in the United States that has destroyed beaches or wildlife in a major way that we have all watched on television in your recent memory.
Juliet Alpern, you're in Washington listening to our caller and to Amy, looking at the environmental situation here, thinking about, you know, Obama no doubt talking about this as a bridge. Do you see this as a necessary bridge? Is it clear in the numbers on energy that we've got to have offshore oil and gas in the mix to make it to some, you know, alternative energy future?
Well, the answer is kind of mixed. There's no question that natural gas is the fuel that everyone sees as the bridge fuel that will help, that will be the backup for, say, you know, wind, you know, energy, electricity generated by wind and solar and so forth. That said, one of the big developments that we've seen in recent years is the ability to tap into shale rock and shale deposits and create natural gas from that, which has its own environmental controversies and consequences, but that said, in some ways may be more popular and certainly is a much more of a sure bet. I just met with a bunch of natural gas executives who said, when you tap into shale, you know that you're getting natural gas out of it. When you're doing offshore oil exploration and gas exploration, it's not a definite bet. And so I think that there are lots of reasons why that may be where you see a larger, you know, growth industry than you see offshore. But again, it remains to be seen.
Juliet Alpern, National Environmental Reporter with The Washington Post. Juliet, thanks very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
We're joined right now from Washington by Joshua Fried. He's director of the Clean Energy Initiative at Third Way. It's a progressive think tank there. Spent a bunch of years working on Energy and Commerce Committee in the support staff in the House. He joins us from Washington. Josh, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What do you see in the president's announcement on offshore drilling? Is this oil and gas for oil and gas sake? Is this a bridge, a step towards something different? How do you look at it?
Look, this is smart policy that moves us in the right direction towards a clean energy future. The president recognizes that we're not going to have 218 million hybrid vehicles or electric vehicles anytime in the near future. And the choice we have until we get there is sending $150 billion a year to countries the State Department deems unstable, or exploring off the coasts of Virginia or Louisiana or Alaska, developing domestic oil and refining in the United States, creating jobs and keeping the United States more secure than it currently is.
Do you agree with Amy Jaffe? You may have heard her say she sees very little environmental risk here. Do you agree?
I think there is minimal environmental risk, and it is something that both President Obama and Secretary Salazar are very sensitive to, and it's why you saw certain tracts, such as Bristol Bay, removed from access to exploration and extraction before they even rolled out the policy.
We've heard people saying that they're worried, as our caller already said, that this will take focus away from alternative energies. We heard that on NPR's morning news this morning. Here's a little clip of a resident of coastal St. Petersburg, Florida. This is Kathy Douglas talking about what she thinks of offshore drilling as an answer to America's energy problems.
I definitely think it is a crutch. And it's a crutch because if we have fossil fuels that are so easily available, then we cease to try to develop the technology that makes alternative energy affordable to the average person.
Josh Fried, what do you think of that analysis on the beach in St. Petersburg?
You know, I understand the interviewee's concerns, but this isn't a zero-sum game. Unfortunately, we can't flick a switch and have all of our vehicles use electricity tomorrow. There will be a long-term demand for oil and gas in the United States. And since we're going to use it anyway, we need to use it in a way that makes the most sense for us environmentally. That means, as your other guest pointed out, we don't bring as much into the United States through oil tankers that are at a much greater risk for spills. And it means that we send less money to unstable governments in places like Nigeria, in Iraq, Angola, and keep that money in the United States.
If this is in no small part a political step on President Obama's part to bring in moderate Democrats and Republicans for a bigger energy package, where's that package? When might we see it? Is something going to be it? There's Senators Kerry and Lindsey Graham and Joe Lieberman are working on something. Are we going to see a package on the table for for Congress and the Senate to go at? And does this offshore drilling step buy the votes to pass that?
We will see a package likely around Earth Day. I think that's April 22nd. The question, it's not an issue of buying votes. It's an issue of putting together common sense policies that will make America less dependent on foreign oil in the short term and over the long term grow a very robust clean energy sector that creates American jobs, improves the American economy, and reduces our dependence on any sort of conventional energy.
I mean, that's very broad. Can we be more specific? There's been a lot of talk about cap and trade, about some kind of price on carbon emissions. Do you see a bill emerging as a kind of part of an equation here with offshore drilling that will put those things on the table and have a chance of passing?
Yes, absolutely. We will see a bill likely, again, around April 22nd, though, as we've seen with everything, the Senate moves much slower than many Americans would like. That will include a price on carbon, likely starting out with the utility sector, which uses 80% of the power generated there comes from coal, and also the transportation sector, meaning some sort of price on oil so that we can start reducing our dependence on oil.
Amy Jeffy, how do you handicap the politics here? Do you see a big energy climate change bill coming out of Washington this year?
Well, this year, possibly. I think that people felt that the problem is you have to get a bill out in May or early May before recess and before we go into the midterm elections. And that seems to me to be very difficult. Constructing a cap-and-trade system, which could be a successful system, is going to take a lot of negotiation. It is as complex as healthcare. And there are a lot of revenues that get generated in the cap-and-trade system. And as you know, in Washington, anytime I'm going to have loose revenue, how I divide up that revenue, am I giving it back to industry in the form of free credits? Am I giving it back to consumers? Am I giving it back to states? There's a lot of different opinion on the Hill about how that revenue should be distributed, whether we should have all permits auctioned, in which case the federal government would take the revenue and use it to spend it on alternative energy or use it to give rebates for people who are suffering under the cost of high energy. There's just a lot of different options, and my feeling is it's money and there's a lot of options, and I think it's going to be very hard for the Senate to come up with something over the course of the month of April and in 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. That seems very difficult to me.
Josh, I'm reading here out of Washington reports that cap and trade is basically been set aside, has been given up on as an option here. If the offshore drilling gets some credit for the president, what's the maximum position he can push for here now? He took a lot of criticism on health care because he cut big deals in advance of putting forward a package with major players in the industry. Is the same thing going on here? How much can Obama push for?
First, I want to take issue with Amy's contention that they only have 3 or 4 weeks to get something done. This is a plan that's been worked on for several years now, and we're at the point where they are putting the final pieces of the puzzle together so that a proposal can be introduced that has broad bipartisan support. It's a common sense plan that will put a price on carbon. Now, it might not use what has been termed cap and trade, which frankly has become a meaningless phrase, but it will include a price on carbon, which means the pollution that a major coal power plant or a natural gas power plant emits will have a price on it that the electric utilities have to pay to be allowed to send that pollution up into the air, and they will have a limit on how much pollution they can emit. It means that there will be less pollution that that goes into the atmosphere. It means that over time we'll have less pollution from heavy manufacturing, from our production and use of gasoline to fuel cars, diesel to fuel heavy trucks. So this is something that that can be done and will be done over the next month and a half. In terms of what deals need to be struck, look, just as with healthcare, this is a very significant change in policy that requires the comfort of a lot of different players, including industries, to ensure that jobs are created, that jobs are preserved, that individual consumers don't get left with a large bill. It's common sense policy. It's, as with healthcare, something that once the American people see it, they will like it and they will appreciate it.
I don't know if that's energy analysis or politics talking. Common sense policy sounds like a political spin.
Well, it's a combination of both. Look, you know, one of the frustrations that we found a lot of the American people has is that they view too many of the policies coming out of Washington to be stuck on one ideological pole or the other.
Let's hear from those American people. Sandra, Penn Laird, Virginia. Sandra, you're on the air.
Hi. Given that these oil companies are private industries and that oil is a world commodity, what guarantee, legally or otherwise, is there going to be that these private oil and gas companies are going to sell all of that product to the United States? What's to keep them from drilling off of our shores and selling it to other countries?
Interesting question. Our time is short before the break. Amy, Jeffy, what do you say?
We already do that. There's already a law in the United States that limits exports from the United States. And also the way the economics of the market works, it costs me money to move oil from one place to another. So if I can sell it right where I'm producing it, I make more money. So I don't think that's something we need to be concerned about. If the companies find product here, they'll sell it here.
I've just got you for another minute. I asked at the outset, but I didn't quite hear your answer. Does this satisfy the oil companies in terms of drilling offshore, or are they going to want, you know, twice as much or three times as much, or what? How do you see the oil industry's interest here?
You know, I have to say the two areas that I think the industry were most interested in were the Eastern Gulf of Mexico and the Shukri Sea. And those two things are on offer here,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the industry should be very pleased with the areas that have been that are being talked about being opened. These are areas where we know, like shale gas, where we know that it's there. Eastern Gulf of Mexico, we know the resource is there. Shukri Sea, we know the resource is there.
And to Republicans who say it's not enough, what do you say, Amy, to the GOP folks who say more? Drill it all.
You know, we need to be also cognizant of the environment. We need to be cognizant that there are some areas where it's harder for the industry to operate than others. And we're looking to have a political compromise where we definitely need to do something. One of the things that have been proposed by Senator Bingaman is a national renewable portfolio standard that would be part of this same package. So, you know, we need to do exactly what the speaker before was saying. We need to have a balanced bill that looks at all our different options, short-term and long-term.
Amy Jaffe, Amy Myers Jaffe at the James A. Baker Institute for Public Policy in Houston, Texas. Thank you for joining us, Amy.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the White House decision to drill for oil and gas offshore and the Obama vision now for energy and the environment. We've been talking with Joshua Fried. He's director of the Clean Energy Initiative at Third Way. It's a progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. Joined right now as well from Carlisle, Massachusetts by Nick Darboloff. He's president of the New England Clean Energy Council. It's a trade group focusing on advancing clean energy businesses. Nick Darboloff, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tom.
What do you see in President Obama's decision on offshore oil and gas, Nick?
Well, I've got to believe that it's an intelligent strategy, the details of which we may not be intimately familiar with yet. If the administration is offering offshore drilling in return for support on climate change legislation, then I think it may make a great deal of sense. And if it's offered unilaterally, I think I'd be very concerned that we're giving away an important bargaining chip at the very moment when congressional support for climate change is most critical.
Well, the companies you work with are crawling all over the energy future, trying to figure out alternatives to fossil fuels. Do you see this as pushing toward that? Are you confident that it will? Are you afraid that the president's just giving away a chit? Or is it clear that, you know, from the clean energy perspective, he's got something brewing here?
Well, the companies I work with certainly are all over the clean tech map and very bullish on the notion that a clean energy economy really driven by a price on carbon can have a huge catalytic effect on their businesses and on really the ability for this nation to rise up and become a leader in a huge industry. I mean, I think that I'm not a political pundit, but I believe the president is a fairly smart individual. And I also know, I think we all know, that he's made it clear that he wants clean energy to be a strong part of his legacy. Therefore, I'm guessing that this is indeed a compromise that has in its sights additional support from some key legislators, and I can't exactly name who those might be, but if Senator Graham, for instance, part of the Kerry Graham-Lieberman effort, indicates that you know he really needs some air support in order to drive forward and get further support from his colleagues, and this is part of such discussions, then I think we've got to do what's necessary to drive towards that price on carbon.
Josh Fried, you're in Washington. If a price on carbon is the key to developing green energy sources in this company, to sort of unleashing the entrepreneurial side of this, do you see that coming? Is it likely to be in the bill that may emerge in the next few weeks?
I think it will be included in the bill. Senators Kerry and Graham and Lieberman all recognize just that we absolutely have to have a price on carbon and some of the money going generated by it going to new research and emerging clean tech companies if we're going to move off of carbon, if we're going to create the new jobs and new industries we need. And to get started on that, President Obama last year in the Recovery Act funded $70 billion for emerging clean energy companies. That includes everything from Tesla, which makes electric vehicles, to new solar and wind companies. So this is something that isn't theoretical. It's already started. You're seeing new technologies being produced by it, new jobs being created, and electricity being generated without fossil fuels. So it's starting to be a reality. We're much farther along in 1 year under President Obama than we were in 8 years under President Bush, but we now need the next step, which is a price on carbon, which Senators Kerry, Graham, and Lieberman will absolutely include in their bill to help us get there. The other point as we talk about oil and gas is that the administration is announcing today their final rules on making cars much more fuel efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that we're going to go from cars being required to get at least 27 miles per gallon starting in 2011 to 35 miles a gallon in 2016. That's a significant decrease in the amount of oil and gas we're going to use, and a very important step towards ultimately dramatically reducing or eliminating our dependence on oil, whether it's offshore or foreign.
Nick Darbaloff, do you agree with that assessment, that in 1 year under Barack Obama, the country is in a far better competitive position on green energy, green industry issues than under 8 years of George Bush? Is that true?
I mean, I think in one sense it absolutely is true, and that sense can be distilled down to this. The attitude of this administration towards the need for clean energy is a tectonic shift from where we were in the early part of this decade. No doubt about it.
But are we suddenly whooping China on this front, and Germany and all the
others? We are certainly not whooping China. In fact, I would say that one of the best lenses through which to look at this entire issue is global competitiveness, because I think China right now is whooping us and doing so fairly cleverly. Last year, in 2009, they out-invested us in clean energy, $34 billion to $18 billion. And I've got to believe that they're quite pleased with the dithering that's going on in Washington with regards to a price on carbon, because they know that every month, every year that goes by, their lead in this incredibly large industry grows substantially.
Wow. Barbara in Belmont, Massachusetts. Barbara, you're on the air.
I edited a book on alternative energy sources about 3 years ago, and I did a lot of research, and I found that, first of all, the under the past administration, back to Reagan, they have held back all of the experimenting with alternative energy sources, so that we've been, in a way, shanghaied into doing this. We were shanghaied because we have not experimented, have not found the right energy sources, because it was not funded on purpose because of the oil companies.
So what do you think about offshore drilling? Does that help get us there? Does it bridge us or not?
No, it won't be a bridge, but I think we're stuck. I think we're stuck because there's no other way to get energy, and it's a tremendous, tremendous amount of energy that we need.
The caller is absolutely correct. I mean, the investment in clean energy over the past several decades has really been shameful. And I think that another part of that tectonic shift I referenced a moment ago is the dramatic increase in investment in alternative technologies.
We've got a lot of responses here online. XC says, I applaud President Obama's decision. Offshore drilling will help our country to become more energy self-sufficient until more green energy technologies can be made available for mass consumption. Bravo, sir. Then here's another that says, as Sarah Palin would say, that whole hope and change thing I voted for in 08 isn't working out too well, but it's not a mistake I'll make in 2012. Obama's more like Bush 3 every day. Hank in Morrisville, Vermont. Hank, you're on the air. What do you say?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just want to make a couple points to save energy. I own a bike shop in Morrisville, and I took huge steps to cut my energy use in half because I think light pollution is equally as bad as car pollution.
Good for you.
And simple measures, if you're not in a room at home, turn the lights off. Ride a bike whenever you can. Turn off the oiling car.
So offshore drilling, nuclear, what about it? Do you buy it as a bridge to the future or not?
Offshore drilling is probably necessary in moderation. I am for nuclear power. I was a nuclear mechanic in the Navy. The problem with the nuclear power now is we haven't built one in 35 years, and with higher concentrations of uranium instead of 2 to 4%.
So you're both conserving in your bike shop and for offshore and for nuclear. I mean, it's getting to be a subtle profile out there. It's interesting. South Hadley, Massachusetts. Dee, you're on the air.
Hi. I think that Obama's opening up the offshore drilling places wasn't a good move. The oil companies presently have many, many offshore oil leases that they're doing nothing with. They know there's oil there, but it's too expensive for them to get it out. They should be made to use those leases or lose them.
That's an interesting point, and I've read the same, Dee. Let us pick it up. Josh Fried, what about it? Oil companies sitting on leases, I've read. Is that true? And if so, why open up new terrain when we've got leases sitting undrilled?
Well, look, there are leases that have been undrilled, and there is consideration of efforts by the administration to push them to either drill or sell the leases. And the challenge has been during the recession, gas prices have also dropped significantly. Unfortunately, it looks very likely that the cost of a barrel of oil is going to go up significantly. It's about $80 now. It may go up to $100, $110 over the summer. And that will make both short-term and long-term a lot of these leases much more economically viable. And if we're going to do that, it makes more sense to drill, look closer to home, than import it from overseas.
Let's go to Janet in Smoke, South Carolina. Janet, you're on the air.
I'm on my Care Energy farm. Our unemployment rate here is 20%. We have crops like sweet sorghum and energy tuber and winter barley and winter millet that are all carbohydrate crops just as easy to turn into ethanol as corn. For 3 years, we have tried to get the money to build a demonstration ethanol plant with the federal government. We can't even get the money to apply, $75,000. We'd already have an ethanol plant working today. Every car in America with a $150 flexible fuel check can run on ethanol. We can get 5 to 6 times as much ethanol per acre as corn, but we can't get the money from the federal government or investors to build one.
So what do you think, Janet, of offshore drilling in that context?
I have been to Galveston, Texas. I have been to Sandy Hook, New Jersey. You have to use lighter fluid to take the oil off the feet of your children because the everyday oil activities spill little bits of oil that wash up on your beaches. It's just sickening to think that they would ruin our beautiful beaches in Florida and South Carolina just for the little bit of oil that's there. Well, we have crops that are ready to go now. All our crops come out of ethanol. This is today's technology.
Janet, we're losing you, but you make your point with passion. Nick Darbaloff, there's Janet. She wants to be part of the clean energy future, can't get the support to do it, and isn't sold on the cleanliness of offshore drilling.
Well, I mean, I'm not sold on the cleanliness of offshore drilling either, but if offshore drilling is a compromise necessary for climate legislation and a price on carbon, then I think it makes sense. She's raising the issue that she can't find the money for an ethanol plant. Or to turn her crops into ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole issue of investment uncertainty is at the very heart of this. In other words, if we don't burden fossil fuels with the full cost of the pollution they produce, then we're never going to see any of the alternative. It's going to take mm-hmm. much, much longer for the technologies emerging today to reach parity with fossil fuels. A price on carbon would create market certainty and would invite billions of dollars of incremental venture investment, commercial lending, and so forth. And I think that for her situation, for the need for her area to convert their crops into ethanol, it is precisely a price on carbon that sends the market signal that will change investment behavior to drive these new technologies.
Janet, thanks for calling, and we wish you luck there. Joseph in Stamford, Vermont. Joseph, you're on the air.
Hello. I'd just like to say there's been, a question about, not about, just about this policy, which I think is another attempt to keep going with a plan that is a massive international failure. I mean, right now,
The fossil fuel agenda.
Sustainable technology, and we know it's going to cause, massive ecological problems with global warming, and we need to seriously move in a different direction. I think calling something clean like coal does not make it clean, and calling nuclear clean does not make it clean. And so far, that's the main results that I see of Obama's policy. I mean, he hired a really great guy, Van Jones, to be in charge of shifting our direction as far as getting green jobs and building green,
And he got hounded out of his position there.
He just chumped out when the right wing gave him a hard time.
Yeah.
So I'm not seeing the courage that other people are seeing, or the direction. Also, Copenhagen shows that basically they're cutting deals with the rich and powerful, and not ignoring the planet and ignoring the poor.
Joseph, we've got the perspective. Josh, let me come to you. You hear that skepticism here on what a lot of people see as a very urgent matter. You speak very glowingly of this, but urgency is a factor here. I mean, do you see the scale and urgency to respond to the energy and climate issues that we're up against?
Are we moving as quickly as I would like or as many people, including the caller, would like? Unfortunately, no. But part of the problem is we have fallen so far behind, and it's not simply an issue of what the last administration did or a political issue. There has been a broad lack of will in Washington to tackle this challenge. It's going to take longer than any of us would like to get there. However, as Nick has pointed out, the first building block we really do need is a price on carbon. We need to make renewables much more price competitive with conventional fuels such as coal, such as oil. Once we do that, there's about $600 billion sitting in investment banks, in private sector, waiting to be invested into new technologies that are truly clean, but they're waiting for the price certainty that a price on carbon will provide to do it. We need to get there first.
Nick Darbaloff, you deal a lot with businesses. Where do you see the money leaning now? Still leaning toward oil and that familiar path to profit? Or, you know, would business like to see us get onto the green field?
No, I think that, let's take the venture community in specific. I think that there's a very, very high level of enthusiasm for the clean energy sector among venture investors. I think there's still a somewhat tentative nature to the number of dollars they're willing to unlock into the segment until such time as there's somewhat greater market certainty. But let's look at some facts here. Energy today is a $6 trillion industry globally. It may well climb to 10 to 12 trillion by mid-century. Clean energy alone may be over $2 trillion by 2020. The 21st century has China's name written all over it, and this is one of the fundamental battlegrounds in which we must work very, very diligently to catch up. And if we don't pass a price on carbon, if we don't jumpstart our efforts to innovate and drive forward on these technologies, we could well find ourselves a secondary economic power, and that's pretty frightening stuff.
We will bear that directly in mind as we watch everything playing out offshore and in Washington. Nick Darbaloff with the New England Clean Energy Council. Thanks very much for being with us, Nick.
Thank you, Tom.
And Josh Fried at the Clean Energy Initiative at Third Way. Thank you for joining us, Josh.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.